Welcome, everyone, to the Filmsmith Podcast, the official podcast for thefilmsmith.com. My name is Remington Smith. I am the writer and managing editor for thefilmsmith.com, and with me is the manager for our podcast, Mr.
Scott Molling.
And so this is our first podcast, so the current format we have situated is going to be a week in review, mentioning the films and things that we've been watching that we want to discuss, followed by mention of any sort of film news that we want to discuss. Our feature segment this week is going to be a discussion of the Academy Award nominations that were released this Tuesday. So we're going to go straight into our week in review. Scott, what have you been watching?
First thing I've been watching is Justified on Blu-ray. I know that show must eke at you a little bit, seeing as you're from Harlan County.
Well, I've lived in Louisville, Kentucky for about 10 years until recently moving to Iowa, and my wife is specifically from Harlan, so whenever we watch it, we're kind of irked by some of the discrepancies, but nonetheless, we do like Walton Goggins, so...
Yes, Walton Goggins.
We give the film the show a little bit of a pass.
So I guess I liked it a little bit more until I realized, after having met you, that you do not have a Southern accent. And so the Southern drawl seemed like most of the appeal to me. But no, that, in my opinion, that show is one of the best shows on TV.
Well, I just wish that... Because they shoot it all in Pennsylvania, which sort of works because there's a lot of coal mining in that area as well, but it doesn't have the hills of Appalachia. You know, I think the opening segment is the only thing that looks like it was actually shot in Harlan, and, but at any rate, go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, I actually had seen the show before when it was on FX last year. It is a kind of a modern Western type show. It's based on an Elmore Leonard short story. What I like so much about it is the dialogue. They really try and stay true to Elmore Leonard's style, and it certainly works really well, especially with the two main characters, Timothy Oliphant and Walton Goggins. It's based on a short story called Fire in the Hole, but I guess the character of Raylan Givens, who is played by Timothy Oliphant in the show, is someone who's been in a whole bunch of Elmore Leonard's stories, and I guess this was just the one they decided to go with. But I've only watched the first 5 episodes. It's a 13-episode season. I had seen it before, but I am just now rewatching it, and I haven't gotten to the good part yet. I think that when we get to the end of the season, and I don't want to spoil it or anything like that, but Walton Goggins, his role really amps up toward the end of the season, and that is by far the part I like the most about the season. But I was surprised by how episodic the show is in the first few episodes. It definitely feels less like a serial, which is more what it gets into later. So I'm kind of surprised that it was able to stay interesting, even though it's an episode where it's like, okay, well, he's hunting out a fugitive this episode, and then he's solving a murder another episode or something like that. So I'm glad that it was able to get past that at the beginning and actually move into a more serialized type of storytelling, which is what I'm more interested in.
What's the quality of the Blu-ray?
Right. The Blu-ray is really good. It is kind of hit or miss sometimes with TV shows because sometimes they're not filmed with the same quality that feature films are. My favorite TV show, Lost, definitely looks amazing on Blu-ray. So that's a good example of TV to watch on Blu-ray. Justified looks really good. I was surprised by how much detail there was and clarity, which I'm not like a big image guru, but I was very surprised by how crisp the picture looked on Blu-ray. So that's another reason to pick it up. And I believe it is on Amazon.com for $21.99 or something like that for the first season.
And that's like 13 episodes.
13 episodes, yeah.
Well, cool. My wife and I were from Kentucky, and so we do have some issues with the show. So our The thing that we like about it is Walton Goggins, so, but other than that, that's why I don't have a lot of comments about it. It's fun. It's fun to watch, but.
I would go so far as to say that the show is almost worth watching for Walton Goggins. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Fun is great, but Walton Goggins, his character has an arc in the first season. He starts out very much the villain, and I wouldn't say he becomes a hero by the end, but he definitely has an arc that you wouldn't expect from a character who is a white supremacist who robs banks.
And was there anything else that you wanted to talk about? What you've been watching?
In addition to Justified, I also saw a documentary last night called Client 9, The Rise and Fall of Elliot Spitzer, which I have to admit, when I first started watching the documentary, I knew very little about Elliot Spitzer. I knew
that he the mayor of New York? I still don't even know that much about
him. He was the district attorney for, I believe, New York City, and then he became the governor of New York, and he had to resign over a sex scandal. And I don't follow the news as much as I should, mostly because most of the stories involve sex scandals, but what I thought I knew about Elliot Spitzer, I thought I knew he had some sort of a sex scandal, and I thought perhaps the reason he resigned wasn't necessarily because of that, but I thought perhaps he used, like, government money to pay for prostitutes or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so I went into the documentary just kind of thinking of him as despicable, and wow, was I turned around by this documentary. It's directed by Alex Gibney, who did Taxi to the Dark Side, and he also did a movie called Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, which I actually saw recently and loved. And this is kind of in the same vein as that, because it's more, I mean, I guess Taxi to the Dark Side is political, but this is more kind of a, I guess, domestic politics.
Do they actually talk to him in the documentary?
They do. Thank you for mentioning that.
Is it after the scandal?
It is after the scandal, but they do have some interesting clips with him on the Colbert Report and talking about about how likable he is and how nothing could possibly damage that. And they're like, you could punch a 4-year-old girl or something like that, and you would still be a governor.
Was this Colbert appearance after the scandal?
No, this was before.
Before, so okay.
The thing that struck me about the movie is that Spitzer did a lot of good things before he became known for his
proclivities.
Yeah, exactly. he brought a new way of approaching white-collar criminals, and especially Wall Street. And he became almost famous, and which is weird because I had never heard of him before the sex scandal, but I guess I don't live in New York, for not tolerating white-collar crime and treating it the same way in the way that he approached it as regular crime.
It almost sounds like you might be hinting that maybe this sex scandal happened because of his work. Is that maybe the narrative in the film?
I will admit that the film is very biased in terms of, it has a liberal bias to it. But there are a lot of shady characters who were not, he made a lot of enemies in that time, and it was those enemies that brought him down. And there's still debate as to what started the investigation that led to his, not arrest, but him having to resign. No one was ever quite sure how they got onto him in the first place and how they got onto this prostitution ring. But what struck me was the reason this movie is so interesting is because he's almost like a real life Harvey Dent, in that he comes in and he becomes this guy who's going to clean up the town, and he's going to put these people behind bars. And I mean, clearly these are not mob people, but it still almost has that.
Probably more important than mob people.
Exactly.
White collar crime does more damage than blue collar crime, but we don't focus on that as much.
Yeah, there's all this stuff about mutual funds and how people were manipulating that, and he brought them down and stuff like that. And so the first half of the movie or so focuses very much on him doing all that in New York and then being elected governor with a landslide victory. He's on his way to the White House. That's what everyone thought. He was going to be the next president. And then for this to bring him down was just a shame, in my opinion. And I feel like, I know I don't want to put myself out there, and I know a lot of people disagree with me, but really his only crime was adultery, in my opinion. And for him, they actually bring up, there was another similar prostitution ring in D.C. that a couple Republican congressmen were involved in, and they didn't even resign. So Spitzer had to resign. He said he did it for his family, and now he's, I guess, starting to try and make his way back into public life. At least that's how the documentary tells it, and I welcome him. I think he can do a lot of good, and I think that if Bill Clinton can stay in the White House after getting a blowjob in the Oval Office, there's no reason why this guy could come back and run for office again. And I don't think that he should be held accountable. I think everybody gets a second chance, and I think he's looking for his now, and I'm willing to give it to him. So that's my opinion on Client 9.
Huh. Okay.
I definitely recommend you should check it out. It's available now on DVD and Blu-ray. I assume it's on Netflix as well.
At some point, maybe it'll be on Netflix streaming.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Is there anything else as far as those films?
Nope.
Okay. this week, my dad, he recommended a film called Flame and Citron. And I was just like, what a weird name for a film, because he mentioned that it was like a World War II film. And this, quite frankly, I mean, it kind of rocked my socks. It's on Netflix streaming. It's a 2008 film. And it's kind of this neo-noir World War II thriller. And what makes it so unique is that maybe in a film like Casablanca, World War II is kind of in the background or is about to happen. I can't remember exactly. But I don't think I've seen a film that actually used characters from World War II to tell a different story from, like, the historical record. So it's a Danish film that follows two resistance fighters, their names Flame and Citron. And so they're going around assassinating Nazi soldiers meanwhile, there's this femme fatale who shows up. And so these people, Flame and Citron, they did exist, but this story that they weave is a little bit different. So I just thought that the atmosphere was really striking, and what they were doing was pretty unique. And also, I'm probably going to butcher his name, but Mads Mikkelsen. He was the bad guy in Casino Royale. He's in this film, and you'll go, oh, that guy.
Is he Flame or Citron?
He's Citron. Flame is, so they're kind of a good cop, bad cop duo. Flame is the one who just walks straight up to somebody and blasts them. He's a pale, red-haired guy. Citron is just kind of this, he looks like he'd just be some office worker. He has these thick frame glasses, and he's usually the driver. And it's just interesting to see how those characters change and then how they both deal with their fate, whatever that is. But yeah, I mean, it's a really cool, interesting take on some real characters in World War II. Also notable for highlighting something other than the U.S. military versus the Nazis. You know, you have Danish resistance fighters, so you get into a more detailed look at the resistance against the Nazis. And then Mads Mikkelsen, he's a lot of fun to watch. It's interesting to see him play kind of this meek character, since the only time I've seen him on screen was when he was this terrible villain smacking Daniel Craig's balls. So
crying blood.
Yeah. So I would highly recommend that you check that out, especially if you're a fan of World War II films. It's got some great mystery as well as some action scenes to it. And that is available on Netflix Instant Streaming. The other thing that I'm going to mention real briefly, since Scott didn't get a chance to watch this over the weekend, I saw The Mechanic. It just came out this Friday. It stars Jason Statham as a, quote, mechanic, someone who...
No. Is this movie about car repair?
No, it is not. In The Professional, they refer to assassins as cleaners, but I guess they're just trying to change it a little bit. So they call this assassin The Mechanic. So Jason Statham, he plays a mechanic who kills people in such ways that makes it look like an accident. And basically, I just wanted to give a shout out to the film because it's a lot better than you would expect. You can read my review on thefilmsmith.com. And in my recent reviews of films like The Green Hornet, I've made mention that the early part of the year is a dumping ground for films that the studio doesn't have a lot of faith in. They have a contractual obligation to release a film. So they just kind of throw it between the award season films and the blockbusters that are looming in the horizon. So I had very low expectations, but Ben Foster co-stars with Jason Statham, and he kind of steals the whole movie. I describe Jason Statham as a wrecking ball. You bring him in to kind of rock the house, but between bits of action, if you're wanting something a little more interesting, you need a different tool. And so Foster, he's smaller in stature, and so maybe he isn't as skilled, but he knows how to act a lot better. And when he starts to kick some butt, it's kind of in more clever ways than just the blunt force of Jason Statham. So also worth noting, this is a rated R action film, so there's like blood everywhere. And the ways in which the goons get killed is, you kind of feel sad for them because they just obviously don't have a chance. So I don't know if strongly is the thing, like you don't have to go out and see this. But if you're wanting to just see something out in theaters, I would recommend The Mechanic. It's got some great action pieces, and Ben Foster makes it worth even maybe a second viewing with some friends. So yeah, Flame and Citron and The Mechanic. Those are the main things I've watched this week.
I haven't seen The Mechanic, and I probably won't, to be honest. But one thing I did find funny about the trailer was that with a movie like The Mechanic, they have to tell you what The Mechanic means in the trailer. They can't let you go see the movie being like, I didn't get it. I thought this movie was going to be about car repair. And so there has to be that scene in the trailer where he says, do you know what a mechanic is? He's like, it's a hitman. It's like, okay, now we got that out of the way. You can enjoy the rest of this action trailer so that you know what this movie is. I just found that kind of funny.
Yeah. And I made a passing reference to a film called The Professional. Definitely check that out if you haven't seen it. Gary Oldman's a crazy-ass cop, and then Jean Reno plays a hitman. And that's also the film that launched Natalie Portman's career, actually. She was 14 at the time.
She might have even been younger than that.
And she basically gets trained in the ways of assassinating, although they don't show it like they do in Kick-Ass. But anyways, we are digressing. You have a news piece that you want to discuss. Is that correct?
I do. I figured this week in review could be a way to highlight some news that we've seen from the last week in film. I'm not necessarily big on discussing film news. I think there are places that will do that better than us. But just something that caught my eye this week. I think this was online yesterday. I got this courtesy of hitfix.com. Aaron Sorkin has a new pilot that just got greenlit by HBO. And it's about a like behind the scenes of a cable news show, like a Keith Olbermann kind of thing. And if you don't know who Aaron Sorkin is, he's currently the Best Picture frontrunner for Best Original Screenplay for The Social Network, which we'll get into in a little bit. His TV credits include Sports Night, The West Wing, and Studio 60. So he definitely has some experience with behind the scenes of TV shows. I mean, Sports Night was about like a sports show, and Studio 60 was about a Saturday Night Live type thing. So now he's going for cable news. Aaron Sorkin might be my favorite writer in the world today. I know that's a lot of overselling it, I guess, but I really like how he writes. I like his mix between drama and comedy. I'm a huge fan of The West Wing. I, unlike many other people, was a huge fan of the first season, or the only season, of Studio 60, and I loved The Social Network, and he's also done things like A Few Good Men, which I would probably rank in my top 10 films of all time. Yeah, so Aaron Sorkin has a new show, and now it's on HBO, which is unlike any other show he's done before, so I'm looking forward to him being able to write people saying swear words. should be interesting. So that was the only news I had.
Okay. Not much else other than our feature segment, which is about the Academy Award nominations.
And so we're going to go through some of the categories. Some of them I don't think we really wanted to discuss. I don't think you're going to hear an in-depth discussion of best makeup here on this podcast. But we did want to talk about the films. And since this is our first podcast, maybe also provide our opinions on some of the films that got nominated, or maybe some of the films or performances that should have gotten nominated.
So we're going to start with Best Original Screenplay. So we've got Mike Lee, Another Year, The Fighter, Inception, The Kids Are All Right, and The King's Speech.
I do want to say I was so happy that Mike Lee's Another Year got nominated here, because I feel like that screenplay is one of the ballsiest screenplays of the year, and not necessarily a movie that people are going to go out and see. And so any recognition, I think it really needed and deserved. And so if that nomination can get people saying, hey, maybe I should go see this movie. I know Mike Lee has been around for a long time and he's got his supporters, but he's not exactly a mainstream film director or writer. And so I was very excited to see him get in there.
Scott and I, we both went to Chicago and we saw Another Year. And I was pretty impressed. It turned out we ended up watching like four films that were all about relationships. And that was one of the better ones. Mike Lee, he also did Happy Go Lucky, which came out in 2008, as well
Secrets
as
Secrets and Lies, Naked, Fear Drake.
So he's pretty well-known British director. He has a very unique style of preparing for his films. Some of the ways he prepared for Another Year, I think I can't remember exactly.
I know he's not as he doesn't stick to the script perhaps as much as other directors might. I know there's a lot of improvisation that goes on his sets. At least that's what I heard when Vera Drake was up for all its awards. I haven't seen a lot of Mike Lee's movies. In fact, I think the only other movie of his I have seen is Happy Go Lucky, and I wasn't really that big a fan of it. But
meanwhile, I really liked it. So.
I was a little angry, I'll say, that it wasn't nominated for, I don't know where they would have put her, Best Leading Actress or Best Supporting Actress, but Leslie Manville.
Oh.
I felt she really deserved a nomination, and I was very angry that she
Do you think she
one.
Was a main lead, or was she supporting?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I follow the Oscars a lot more than you do, but there was, originally she was going to go lead, and not her personally, but whoever controls those things.
Yeah.
And I don't know if maybe there was too much competition in that category, which, I mean, that is a pretty heated category this year. So there was a lot of talk about how possibly she might end up in the supporting category, and then she got left out altogether, so I was pretty disappointed with that.
Yeah, Manville might be one of the standout performances of the year. She was amazing. So I would say the story alone merits seeing another year, but Manville's performance is pretty incredible. So really funny, kind of the typical type of British wordplay that you would expect, but in a way that, I mean that in the most positive way, not in any sort of derogatory way. It's just a lot of wordsmith, the filmsmith. That was terrible. But, I mean, it's an excellent film, and hopefully that could at least win for best writing, because I think maybe out of all of these, that probably merits it the most.
I'd say that's pretty unlikely. I would say The King's Speech pretty much has this one locked up. And when you're a Best Picture frontrunner and you have as little competition in terms of what people liked, and I don't mean like a person, I don't mean like me or just, I mean in general, the Oscar voters, it seemed like they really, really liked The King's Speech. And I think it's going to be very hard for anything to pull an upset in that category.
Well, and I think there's a good opening to talk a little bit about the politics of the Academy Awards, because before we go headlong into this whole thing, I'm not too much of a fan of the awards now that I know a little bit more about them. There's a lot of politicking that goes along. Famously, the Weinstein brothers, they dump a lot of money on their film acquisitions, and The King's Speech just happens to be one of them this year. Yep. So there's a lot of campaigning. I don't know the exact ways in which they're able to campaign for their votes, but at least enough promotional material and access to a film so Academy voters can see it. There's a lot of money spent on it. So something like Shakespeare in Love in 98, when it was up against Saving Private Ryan, is a very
pretty egregious.
It's a pretty infamous example of an upset by this means of campaigning.
Although there might be just as many people who are not saying Saving Private Ryan, but The Thin Red Line. So it really goes to say, what is an Oscar movie? And there's certainly a type. I think The King's Speech is a perfect example of an Oscar movie where it's about overcoming adversity. It's a period film. It's got royalty in it.
British accents.
And film is subjective. We're not always going to get the movies that we like being nominated for Best Picture. I mean, another year, a smaller film like that won't necessarily get the support. Although, I will say, we'll get to it later, but Winter's Bone got nominated this year for Best Picture, and I was very satisfied with that.
I was really flabbergasted by it, so.
But, I mean, now that you've made clear your opinion on the Oscars, I'm
Well, yeah, and it's opinion as well as, like, a little bit of history about it, because also the way in which people vote on it, like, something like the Directors Guild Awards, you know, it's directors voting on someone's directing capabilities.
True.
But the way in which the Academy does it, you can have people from all sorts of backgrounds voting on the best acting, even if you are a director. Well, that's a bad example.
Well,
like a sound mixer voting on best acting. And there was an article I read recently where somebody pointed out it's less about best of something and more about the most of something. So most editing, most special effects, most acting. I thought that was pretty succinct. So that's a little bit of that. And, you know, if you enjoy the awards, that's fine. It's just, this is some of the history, and also, you know, it's just known for, well, let's try and promote the hell out of certain films that we have put together and we really need to make some money back on. So I think that's why you have Best Picture nominations open up to 10 films, and you have some films that don't belong up there, like last year's Avatar, over something like John Hillcoat's The Road. So that'll be my soapbox.
Well, allow me to retort, I suppose. I guess I've been a fan of the Oscars for, I'd say, about 10 years now, and what struck me so much about the Oscars was the power of those who win, and the ability for somebody, let's say, a great example, I'd say, is Danny Boyle for Slumdog Millionaire.
Very true.
After he won, he was given free rein to make whatever project he wanted to do next, and I really don't think, I mean, say what you will about 127 Hours, it wasn't my favorite movie of the year by any means, I liked it. But that movie would have never gotten made had he not won Best Picture. That is a movie about one man with his arm crushed under a rock for an hour and a half. That is not a movie that Hollywood typically makes. And because Danny Boyle won this award, he was able to go and make art that wouldn't normally be there. And I think that's commendable of the Oscars for at least raising awareness. And another thing, movies like Winter's Bone, movies like Another Year that got nominated this year, those movies will be seen by more people now, and I don't think that's a bad thing by any means.
I don't disagree with that. I guess it's just the propensity for films that are already well-known to be kind of lumped in with the critical, or what most people, I would assume, view the Oscars as a critical assessment of films in the United States. And my problem is that it's not as much about a criticism, but just about the most distinction, like the most editing, so whatever.
I won't argue with that. Born Ultimatum won best editing, and that baffles me to this day.
Yeah. So, but I do agree. I mean, I think this is, I'm really happy that Winter's Bone could get nominated because that's one of my favorite films of the year. So, you know, that came out in the middle of the year, and without the Academy Awards, maybe a lot of people would pass it by entirely. So I will concede that, but I just have some problems with it. Yeah. So,
now that we've talked about that, let's get back to these meaningless awards and talk a little bit more about these nominees.
Let's see. So we were on screenplay. Now we can go to adapted screenplay. So the nominations, 127 Hours, The Social Network, Toy Story 3, True Grit, and Winter's Bone.
What do you think is going to win?
I mean, I'm never gonna try and pick what's gonna win. I mean, out of what I'm seeing here, I'm sure you'd probably vote The Social Network, but since I wasn't too much of a fan of it, Winter's Bone was the thing I liked the most. But maybe True Grit had the best. Maybe I would say True Grit because it was just, I liked the wordplay. I thought that was, But you didn't like True Grit that much. I'm not a big True Grit fan.
We don't have to get into that too much, but...
Which one did you really like? Then we'll just say that.
Aaron Sorkin for The Social Network. I think this is his first Oscar nomination, which I find to be an egregious error on their part that he hasn't been nominated before. I really feel like A Few Good Men, which was nominated for Best Picture that year, definitely should have picked up a screenplay nomination because that's half that film, let's be honest.
Yeah.
And the other half is acting. So I don't know if Rob Reiner got nominated for Best Director, but if he did, certainly Aaron Sorkin should have been nominated for Best Screenplay. But I really like The Social Network. I've seen it 3 times now, and every time I'm just baffled by how good that writing is. And I really, I love that dialogue, and I think he really knocks it out of the park, and I feel like he really deserves this award, if for no other reason than as a Lifetime Achievement Award. And I mean, I know he's still fairly young, but... I know that that's something, another thing that people have problems with the Oscars is that they tend to give out awards sometimes for people who might have been snubbed in the past. I mean, let's face it, Martin Scorsese's best film is not The Departed, and yet that's what he has his Oscar for. Al Pacino's best performance is not for Scent of a Woman.
Denzel Washington in Training Day.
Yes.
So,
but over time, people forget what you won the Oscar for, and they just remember that you've won an Oscar. And I wouldn't say that The Social Network is... by any means his worst screenplay. I wouldn't say it's his best screenplay, but I would say that it is very deserving of this award. And if I had to choose a winner based on merit alone, I would pick Aaron Sorkin for The Social Network.
Yeah, I mean, despite my problems with The Social Network, again, you can read my review, thefilmsmith.com, but maybe that's too much pluggage. I just don't know how to refer to these things, so you
Everyone
guys
go
can
to
read
thefilmsmith.com.
About... Yeah, go right now, or we will get you.
But since we're talking about The Social Network, I suggest you drop the, just Filmsmith. It's cleaner.
But after that movie, I really did think about it. I was like, The Filmsmith or Filmsmith.com? And I asked a few people, and they're like, no, The Filmsmith works. So anyways, that was just riffing off of The Social Network.
Yeah, it's a bad joke.
It was an okay joke. It was funny for a wah, wah.
I'll keep trying.
If you're done, I think we can talk about the best original score. We have How to Train Your Dragon, Inception, The King's Speech, 127 Hours, and The Social Network.
Well, the thing that bothers me so much about that nomination for The King's Speech is the composer, Alejandro Desplat, or Desplat, I don't know how to pronounce French names. He scored another movie this year, a little-known picture called Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1, which I found that score to be amazing. And I'm a little angry that you can't be nominated in a category twice if you're the composer, or for anything, really. So I was kind of bothered by the fact that he couldn't get in there for both. I feel like The King's Speech score is perfectly fine, but not anything to write home about.
Yeah.
And I thought the score for Harry Potter was really, really good and one of the best that the franchise has had to offer, for
and
sure.
Harry Potter being Scott's number one film of the year, so understandably upset. I mean, the King's Speech wasn't that remarkable. How to Train Your Dragon, eh.
I would refute that. I think the score for that is very, very good.
But I think what stands out the most is probably Hans Zimmer for Inception, and then Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross for The Social Network. I think either one of those would be good. Maybe even A.R. Rahman for 127 Hours. I mean, this year there have actually been some pretty remarkable scores.
And that's leaving out the score for Never Let Me Go, which I thought was amazing.
That was pretty good.
There's probably 10 other scores that I can't think of right now. But this year was a really good year for original scores. And the fact that Black Swan has an amazing score, it really works for the film. And True Grit, I wasn't a big fan of, but a lot of people were. So there's... If this category could have 10 or 15 nominations, it wouldn't have been hard to fill.
So what do you think? I mean, I think it's going to be, since you've started the prediction game, I'm just going to say, I would say it's probably going to be a toss-up between Hans Zimmer and Trent Reznor.
I would say those are definitely the two front-runners. Say what you will about Inception. I wasn't a big fan of it, but I did really like the score. I thought there was a lot good about that.
I mean, part of the reason that I went to see it up to three times is I just wanted to hear that freaking music, like just with an awesome bass. And so it was almost more like a concert experience. So I was more than happy to see it multiple times just for the music. So
I would say those two are definitely the front runners. If I had to pick the winner, I'd go again with Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross for The Social Network. I love that score. And another score that came out this year that people love is Tron Legacy's score, which is by Daft Punk.
That.
And a lot of people think that that has a very unique style. I mean, I'm sure it does, but I wasn't a big fan. I thought it was overused in the movie, and I think a big piece of original score can't be just listening to it on its own. It has to be a score that works for the movie, and I don't think that... I mean, Tron Legacy's a bad movie, and let's face it.
But, I think it's an eh movie. I mean, it hits a lot of the same tropes and things that we're used to seeing. I have to say, though, I think that without the visuals, the visual look of that film, just the production design, and without the music, I think that it would be a bad movie. So,
for the record, and I don't think it was nominated for Best Visual Effects. I think that was one of the snubs. We're not going to talk about visual effects.
But I mean, I've listened, actually, in the last couple weeks, all I've been doing is listening to the Tron Legacy soundtrack. So I think it's, hell, just a give Daft Punk an Oscar nomination should be pretty sweet. But yeah, actually, I would say that this could, they should have been nominated. I'm going to say that. I'm going to say that Tron Legacy should have been nominated over The King's Speech or How to Train Your Dragon, even. Oh. Because How to Train Your Dragon's music, it just sounded sweeping and John Williams-y.
That's what's good about it.
But it didn't stand out, like, at all to me. So.
Okay.
So anyways,
but back to my original point on Tron Legacy, I think that the Social Network score is kind of in a similar vein. It has kind of that, like,
moody.
I don't know if I am in an opinion to speak educatedly about
music.
Techno music or whatever you want to call it, but I do think that they have kind of a similar quality, kind of a synth quality to them, and I thought the Social Networks pulled it off in a way that you wouldn't expect that to work in a movie that features a lot of talking, and I thought it really did, and I thought I give a lot of credit to Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross.
I mean, that opening scene where we're watching Mark Zuckerberg create Face Mash is awesome. And part of it is the way that Fincher shoots and edits that scene, but also it's that music really making it thrum with some sort of intensity.
For sure. And another thing, that opening scene where he's walking across campus, that has, in my opinion, the best part of the soundtrack or the score. And it is probably the thing that most people will remember is the piano playing over the strings. They actually released online that clip with the song that Aaron Sorkin had written into the script to play over that track and that he was originally going to use. And it doesn't work nearly as well. It's a completely different tone. It doesn't start the movie off the way that the movie starts off now. And I think that I would almost go so far as to say you can't have a truly great movie unless you have a truly great score. And obviously that doesn't apply for certain movies, but especially for bigger budget, more epic, not that The Social Network is an epic movie, so I guess this is a bad example, but I feel like movies like The Lord of the Rings or Pirates of the Caribbean or something like that, they are elevated by those amazing scores.
Indiana Jones comes to mind.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah. So I really, really like that score, and I thought it added a lot to the movie that wouldn't have been there if there had been no score and they had just used pre-existing music or somebody else had written the score.
Yeah. I, despite my issues with Social Network, that the music was awesome. So we're going to segue into the documentary feature section. So we've got Inside Job nominated, Exit Through the Gift Shop, Gasland, Restrepo, and Wasteland. So some of these films you may or may not have heard about. I saw Restrepo at the Edinburgh International Film Festival this year. You can find that review online. Basically, it just documents American soldiers in the Korangal Valley in Afghanistan. Just kind of shows the mundane absurdity in some ways of war. I think that the filmmakers were embedded with them, I want to say 2 years, but don't quote me on that. I don't know much about Gasland. I assume it's probably going to be something about fossil fuels and depleted
resources. I'm sure it's telling us how we should all be more green.
Yes, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just some of these documentaries, it's hard to... But anyways, we're rambling. But the real thing I would want to talk about is Exit Through the Gift Shop. It's a film produced by famous street artist, or to some people, just graffiti artist. And he helped direct a film called Exit Through the Gift Shop, which I believe is that available on Netflix?
Yeah.
So that's on my top 10 list of the year. And I'm kind of surprised that it made it, though. Like, I just thought it was something film sphere, but I didn't know that it was...
A lot of people felt the same way. I think they felt that the Academy doesn't like outsiders, that they like to award their nice little group, their friends. And so Banksy, this guy that no one knows... And by the way, I'm interested to see what would happen if he won.
Because Banksy has been very cagey about revealing his identity to anyone, and he doesn't reveal it in the film. So if he were to win, who knows in what way his award would be accepted. And knowing Banksy and his flourish for publicity...
I'm sure he has something planned.
And I would also recommend that you check out the intro to The Simpsons that Banksy did. It kind of got... some media attention in the fall last year, I think, and it's pretty brutal, I guess, in some ways. So I would check that out. So anything else you want to say about that other than X Through the Gift Shop? It would be awesome if it could win, but Inside Job, it sounds like.
Yeah, I would say Inside Job is probably the front runner, just because for documentaries, they seem to pick movies like that. They seem to pick the important film. Last year was The Cove, which was my favorite documentary of last year as well. But again, it's about an issue. It's about something important that they want people to do things about.
Well, and the thing that makes Exit Through the Gift Shop so interesting is that it weaves a narrative, and it's not so issue-driven. It's about one guy and his place in this new street art scene, and then questions of, well, what is art? And questioning this, interrogating this character of like, well, why is he doing this? And questioning his motives and his methods.
It starts as this nice little film about street art, and that's what you think it's going to be about. And that's kind of what everybody was saying it was. They were saying it's a street art documentary. I was like, okay, so it's about street art. And then you watch it and you're this epic tale of greed and corruption and art and hype and all this stuff just comes out of it.
Really a struggle for self-definition of the art form as Banksy becomes more notable, as he's shown in the film. High-class collectors are buying his stuff for $500,000, $1 million. And, you know, by design, this art is not supposed to be consumed in that way. It's not supposed to be collected, you know. I think it was the IFC News podcast. They said that at Sundance, there might have been some Banksy art that would crop up, but then they'd like start taking down that wall of a building to then commodify that art that was created. So it's an antithesis to the form. And so the film is just kind of struggling with how to define themselves in light of this new fame.
And it's an idea of what comes from when you have something that's very cool and not any way related to money. It's just what's popular. And then when you take that popularity because it's so cool and because it's so outside of the mainstream and you monetize it.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting concept because everything, what Banksy does, and I mean, let's not criminalize Banksy because I don't think it's him in the movie that's the one who's going from street art to money, money, money. Like
he is directing the film, so I mean, he could frame himself in whatever light he wants.
Very true, very true. And
but the motives that we are provided and what we know about his art, you know, this isn't something he's. I mean, if he wanted to become popular, then why would he be anonymous, I guess, is one way of doing it.
There are many ways for him to monetize even more what he's doing, and he doesn't do it because he does it, I don't know, for the thrill or whatever. I'm not like an expert on Banksy by any means. I really didn't even know who he was until this documentary was made.
Most of it seems to be about a political rebellion as well as probably the thrill of doing it. So,
and then this guy who's just like, he's a fan. He's just, oh, this is so cool what you're doing. And then,
but not necessarily even a fan. He's just a compulsive documenter.
True. But I think he really finds interest in what they're doing and wants to do it himself.
But I think that's just a reflection of his personality, because before we find out he's a vintage shop owner and all he does is buy clothing in bulk and then retags thrift store clothes as vintage and marks it up by a bajillion dollars. So I think it's more about whatever's cool and what's going on. I don't know if it's necessarily out of some...
Not that specifically.
Yeah. And I think that that's reflected in his art. You know, there's not like a deep connection. It doesn't seem like there's a deep connection to the street art scene as much as there's not a deep connection to the art that he starts creating.
Yeah, and the art he creates, I mean, it looks cool to a certain extent. There's some things I'm reminded of Elvis, instead of holding the guitar or whatever, he's holding a machine gun.
But the way he describes it, it's just...
There's no depth to it. I mean, everything is surface value. He's just like, I made this because it looks cool and because this is... In a weird, crude way, also what Banksy's doing, except...
But he doesn't say that.
He doesn't say it, okay.
Yeah.
Interpreting him as is that, like, he takes stuff that has meaning and depth beyond just its surface value, but he only sees it for the surface value. And so he recreates as best he can that surface value, but the soul of what was there originally is now gone.
Yeah, I mean, it's very derivative of Warhol and what else is going on in the street art scene. So at any rate, you know, obviously we are really interested in it. And
clearly we would both vote for Exit Through the Gift Shop to win this award.
Yeah, so, but the likelihood of it getting it, maybe not so much, but it's probably the best one that you can probably watch. And also to give you a new appreciation for what documentary films can do instead of being limited by issue-driven topics.
And a lot of people are wondering, well, if it's not real. I mean, this story almost feels too good to be true in a certain extent. And a lot of people are saying, does that make the film better or worse if it's fake? And to be honest, I think it's such a work of art in the way it's constructed that it could either be Banksy came up with this story on his own and wrote and made this movie about all these epic things, and that is commendable.
And he's genius.
Or he saw it and saw it for what it was when it was really happening and constructed it the same way. And that's equally genius.
Whether it's fake or real, it doesn't change the effect of the narrative. I mean, it doesn't change
the themes that are up there.
Yeah, that too. I mean, but as far as like narratively, you know, like if everything's staged, well, does that change the impact it has on you? Or if it's all real, does that change the impact on you? No, because it's just this interesting character study and then trying to look and seeing what it's like for a bunch of people to try and determine their own representation, which I could go on a little bit on, but that seems to be the struggle for the 21st century is how do we represent ourselves? I mean, I think that's why you have Facebook statuses and Twitter posts is you're trying to get out from under the rock of a few conglomerates being able to represent everyone. So anyways, so check out Exit Through the Gift Shop. We're going to move to our animated feature film. And there are only three films, so what are we going to say? How to Train Your Dragon, The Illusionist, and Toy Story 3. Let's start with Toy Story 3.
Yeah, it's nominated for Best Picture, so it's going to win, right?
Well, it's Pixar. They have a very good record for that. So I can't remember. Not a fan? Eh?
Not a fan at all.
Okay. The only thing I really liked about it was the moment when, spoiler alert, for anyone who hasn't seen
it. I think everybody's seen it, but that's the highest grossing movie ever. Yeah. I think everybody's got it.
Spoiler alert, but my favorite part was when the toys were gonna die. And I don't say that.
Was it also your least favorite part, though, because they don't die?
Yeah, yes. I mean, it's twofold. I mean, first, I just want to say it's not out of malice, but it's something that you just don't do in an animated film, and it's ballsy to see them do that. I mean,
for sure.
All the toys are looking at each other and holding hands, and they're accepting their fate, and I was just like, holy crap, they're going to kill them. And, you know, double plus good points for Pixar for being willing to do that. And so, on the one hand, yes, initially I was like, what a cop-out. They literally have a Deus Ex Machina moment where they're rescued by the little aliens. But I could understand the thematic reason of, okay, Woody comes to accept that he's going to die in that one moment. But since he doesn't die, at the end, he is able to go with who is most important to him. And those are his friends and not Andy. You know, I think that accepting, like, okay, these are the people that are most important because we were just staring death in the face and we escaped. So, but the best parts of the Pixar films of late, from Wall-E to Up, now to Toy Story 3, is when it wants to be a little more adult. And I think that it, you know, it shows that they can make animated films for adults. And I think that it represents a respect for their audience, adult or child, and not wanting to mollycoddle them. That's a fun word that I appreciate.
Very true. I mean, it really is raising the awareness, or I guess the quality of what kids watch.
Pixar and also, is. I mean, and it just allows animated films in the U.S. to kind of open their wings a little bit. You know, that opening sequence of Up is amazing and brutal, but it shows that animated films can deal with tough subjects, and it doesn't always have to be kiddie fare. I mean, when you think about Wall-E and when you think about Up, you remember those moments, those serious moments, like those landscape shots in Wall-E. But you don't really remember the rest because it was just all adventuresome fluff. So anyways, that's my comment about Toy Story 3, is I thought that the ending was pretty bold, even if I was a little sad that they couldn't go all the way with it. But I could understand. I mean, did you think that it was just overrated?
I feel like it reached sometimes for that drama. I think that there's a scene very early on in the movie, it's the beginning of the movie, where Andy is going to leave for college, and then he decides to not bring his toys with him or something like that. And I feel like they try to make it so dramatic that he's leaving his childhood toys behind. And I'm sitting here thinking, I have so many childhood toys in my parents' basement that I don't play with, and no one cares that I don't play with them. The only reason we care is because we know these toys are alive. Andy does not know that. Andy's mother does not know that. So why are they creating the sadness out of these toys that he played with 10 years ago and when he was a completely different person?
I feel like they were trying to build off of the previous films and the affections that we're supposed to have with the characters. And I remember them vaguely enough. But yeah, I mean, I'm kind of with you. I felt it was kind of a false sense of sentimentality that wasn't really delivered in the best way. But it's problematic. You know, it's the third film, and how do you, like, build up to that moment without eating up a bunch of the time? So
now that we've talked about Toy Story 3 enough, I mean, it's pretty clear this is going to win, right? Because it was nominated for Best Picture. How on earth could anything beat it?
It made a ton of money. How to Train Your Dragon would be, if anything was going to upstart it, is that the word?
Upset. Perhaps?
Upset, thanks, yeah. I was thinking of young upstart. How to Train Your Dragon, maybe, because it's DreamWorks, and DreamWorks has always been chasing the coattails of Pixar, but
yeah, for sure.
Don't really know.
Pixar's kind of got a hammer lock, as it were, on this category, and I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. I do think that How to Train Your Dragon was a better film this year. In fact, I think The Illusionist was too, so it's kind of a thing where I know Toy Story 3 is going to win, because how does a movie get nominated for Best Picture and not even beat two other movies that weren't nominated for Best Picture? Perhaps animators decide, or somebody decides, well, the animation was better in this one, so I want to go with this, or something like that, even though I think this movie was a better picture as a whole. But I think when they're voting for animated feature, they're not... I think maybe when they're nominating it, when the animators are nominating it, they maybe think, The Illusionist is this, it's bringing animation back in a way that we don't see very much, and so they want to nominate it, but there's no way it's ever going to win, because I don't think the actors branch is really going to cling to a movie that has no dialogue, for example.
Which cuts back to my comment about how the Academy votes. You know, you can have people from all sorts of backgrounds voting on.
But the nominations are done by the people who are in that department.
So. So I'm just saying when it comes down to who gets the award,
yeah,
you know, it can be like Danny DeVito can decide that this is the best animated feature film, even though he doesn't know what it's like to have to animate a feature film, which is why I think that those guild awards are very...
Yet at the same time, if you look at the Directors Guild, for example, versus the best director at the Oscars, the winner is almost always the same person. And the nominees are almost always the nominees, I guess, would be the exact same for the most part. But yeah, I think it's one of those things where the movie should be voted by everybody, because we're not looking for what the best animated movie was in terms of its animation by the people who animate. We're looking for what movie did all these people enjoy the most. And I think, I don't know, maybe I'm babbling,
I'm just,
but...
I what I'm impressed with, though, is that The Illusionist even made it on this list.
It was on the outskirts, for sure. I think Despicable Me would probably be the other movie that would have gotten in instead of The Illusionist. So it's nice. I mean, last year there was that, I don't know, was it called Secret of Kells? That was that movie that got in. They always want to go for a small one that's not computer animated and stuff like that. They always want to remind people that maybe this isn't the only kind of animation. I have no problem with that.
And just so people know, The Illusionist is by Sylvain, and I'm probably messing up his name, he's French, Sylvain Chomet. He did The Triplets of Belleville, and The Illusionist is based on a script or a screenplay by Jacques Tati, although evidently there's a little bit of a brouhaha over ownership of that. But I feel like I've already said this, but I caught that opening night at the Edinburgh International Film Festival. And I think in terms of doing something interesting cinematically, I think the Illusionist is the best animated feature film on this list. It is a bit of a slog because they wanted to make a film that has no words spoken. There might be a few characters who make a little bit of noise, but very, like, no dialogue whatsoever. So it is kind of difficult, but at the same time, the animation is a throwback to doing things more hand-drawn, although obviously there are some effects done. The movement of vehicles looks a little weird, but in its silence and relying on visually telling you this story, that's something that I think a lot of filmmakers forget, is that they can show you things instead of telling you things. And so even though I was having trouble staying awake and into it, maybe about halfway, two-thirds the way through, the ending just, it packs a good punch. And so if you're looking for something more interesting, something new, something you probably haven't seen before, I would highly recommend that you try and find The Illusionist. It's probably in limited screenings at the moment.
I saw it in Chicago, so I know it's there.
Yeah.
So if you live in one of the three biggest cities in the country, you can probably go see it.
Yeah. For the rest of us, we'll just have to wait until it comes out on DVD. But How to Train Your Dragon, it was fun. I think I probably liked Dragon maybe more than Toy Story 3. I would recommend that you check that out as well. So yeah. Best Supporting Actor.
And the nominees are
Christian Bale for The Fighter, John Hawkes for Winter's Bone, Jeremy Renner for The Town, Mark Ruffalo, The Kids Are All Right, and Jeffrey Rush for The King's Speech.
My first comment would be how happy I am that John Hawkes is in there.
Yeah, it's only been recently when people, when I've been listening to podcasts, just so everyone knows, if you're listening to this podcast, then you probably want to check out the Slash Film Cast. And also, I listen to the IFC News podcast every now and again, and Scott, you've got a couple of favorites.
I'd throw up Battleship Retention in there. That's probably my favorite film podcast.
So I've been listening to some of those podcasts, and I kind of forgot about how awesome he is in Winter's Bone, and some of the scenes. I mean,
I almost don't want to spoil his role.
Because he starts
out in such a different way than he ends. And you know what? I just said too much there. And going to that movie, I knew nothing about that movie. And so to go in and see his character and see what a despicable guy he is, and then kind of to see where he goes from there, it's just, he nails it. And John Hawkes has always been that guy for me. You know, like when you watch a movie and you're just like,
that's right,
it's that guy.
Because in a podcast, they mentioned that he is the main guy in You and Me and Everyone We Know. And I really want to, that was some little indie film that I remember liking. It was quirky. But he plays a totally different guy than what he is in this.
The first thing I ever saw him in was, let's say, 2001, was he had a 2 or 3 episode stint on 24's first season, and he played just kind of he was the first guy that got him to the next guy, essentially. I guess that's a common phrase on Law and Order, that you have to go through 6 guys before you finally get to the killer. He was one of the lower level conspirators,
suspects,
I guess, as it were, that Jack Bauer tracks down in the first season. And I remember being impressed and thinking he really did a good job with his role. And then every time I would watch something, or every time once in a while, I'd be like, hey, it's that guy. And whether it's Eastbound and Down, or it's Lost, where he had a great role in the final season for maybe 3 episodes, he was just one of those that guys that I never knew his name. And then, in my opinion, he's the best part of American Gangster, which is not a good movie in my opinion, but I think he really does a great job in that movie. And I think it was around that time, or maybe it was when he was in the final season of Lost, where I was just like, what is his name? I gotta know his name. And then I'm like, oh, it's John Hawks. Okay, I'm going to remember that guy. And then I see Winter's Bone, and I'm like, hey, it's John Hawks. It's not that guy anymore. And then all of a sudden he's being nominated for an Oscar for this. And I'm just like, wow, that's great. Because now he's not going to be that guy to other people now. People are going to know his name, and he's going to get work. And that's another thing that I think is so great. And I mean, if you look at Michael Shannon, for example.
Who was in Shotgun Stories.
Have you seen Shotgun Stories?
Yeah, I really liked it.
Okay, good. We got to talk about that sometime, because I love that movie.
So Shotgun Stories, and then he was also in My Son, What Have You Done? It was directed by Werner Herzog and produced by David Lynch. Yep.
But yeah, so he was in Revolutionary Road, and before that he was in, I mean, I'd seen him in like Lucky You and Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
We're talking about Michael Shannon, by the way.
Yeah, not John Hawks anymore. We've moved on.
Screw you, John Hawks. Yeah, forget the supporting actor confinement that we were doing.
Anyway, so Michael Shannon was in Revolutionary Road in 2007, I believe. No, 2008. And he was nominated for an Oscar, which was kind of a surprise at the time. It seems like every year there's a supporting actor nomination where it's just like the one guy that they're going to say, we're going to start your career. You may be 40 years old, but your career starts now. And it was Michael Shannon a couple of years ago, and he's gotten so much work now. And I mean, he's been typecast a little bit as the creepy guy, but I still feel like
he does have a weird face.
He wouldn't be getting nearly as much work as he is now if it wasn't for that supporting actor nomination. And I feel like that the same thing's going to be with John Hawks. I feel we're going to see him everywhere now. And that's not a bad thing by any means. I would love to see him in every movie.
Yeah, so John Hawks in Winter's Bone.
John Hawks has no chance of winning this award. So yeah. Let's talk about the people who are going to win this award, or the person.
And, I guess I was going to... let me check something.
It's Christian Bale, for those of you who are wondering who's going to win this award.
Okay, good. I'll have a chance to talk about Jennifer Lawrence, who co-stars with John Hawks in Winter's Bone.
Plenty to say about her as well.
So we're still on Best Supporting Actor. So we got Christian Bale in The Fighter. You just talked about John Hawks. Okay, Jeremy Renner in The Town. He's not really there that long, and he kind of...
Well, he's in quite a bit of the movie. I mean, he has kind of the big scene at the end with the drinking of the soda as he's about to...
Okay.
I won't say anything.
The Town. Well, I'll at least use this as a launch pad to tell everyone that... Okay, you may or may not know, but Ben Affleck has started directing movies, and he's actually really good at it. And so despite how much people want to rip on him... He did Gone Baby Gone in 2007.
For those of you who haven't seen Gone Baby Gone, it's probably one of the best made American movies of the last decade. You should really check it out.
It's a great, I don't know what to call it, action thriller thing. I don't know.
It's good. That's what it is. It's really, really good.
Yeah. It has Morgan Freeman in it. It's Ed Harris.
Ed Harris is amazing.
But Casey Affleck. As a legitimate, scary, intimidating, wiry dude.
Yeah, up until then, I think I had seen Good Will Hunting, and he was the...
Yeah, I mean, he's always been Ben Affleck's younger brother and the little goofball, but...
He's almost like playing that role in every movie he was in.
But ever since Gone Baby Gone, he's been doing more serious work.
He had the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, he got an Oscar nomination
for that. Last year, he was in The Killer Inside Me, which I've yet to see.
I have seen it. It's bad. It's really bad.
Oh, okay. But anyways, see Gone Baby Gone. And so the reason I bring up Gone Baby Gone is because The Town is Ben Affleck's second film, and it's more action-oriented. And it was pretty good. I liked it.
I had problems with it, but overall I wouldn't say it was a bad movie. I liked it, especially
for this moment with Jeremy Renner was pretty good. For sure. Pretty good.
Looking back, I would say that's a scene that is so memorable. And I think it'll be one of those movie moments where years from now people are saying, like, that moment at the end of The Town with the soda, the soda can or whatever.
I guess maybe I won't say anything spoilers. Else,
but like he takes a drink of soda in a very dramatic situation that it's great. It's something unexpected.
And also the way they do the heists is pretty interesting. Like, in some ways, something I hadn't seen before. And then there's a pretty intense car chase in some very narrow roads.
So. I don't even want to get into how much I hated that car chase.
But... Okay. So anyways, Jeremy Renner, The Town, I say question mark because I don't know if that necessarily merited it.
I'm not entirely convinced. I think his performance was a little over the top. But I think that they're still high on Hurt Locker.
Yeah.
And I think that it's just one of those things where they're like, hey, this guy we never noticed before, we're finally noticing him now, so now let's heap all the praise that we weren't heaping on him before.
Jeremy Renner, who is in The Hurt Locker, which, did he get nominated for that last year?
He did, yes. Okay. And he was also in the, I was going to make a joke, but I guess I do like the movie, the underrated movie SWAT. He is one of the main characters in that movie with Colin Farrell and Samuel L. Jackson. That's a movie from my youth. I guess. I guess it's not that old. He's good in it, and it was the first movie I ever saw him in, and then, like, when he first started getting into stuff, I don't know. I feel like there are a couple movies I'm not remembering that were just before The Hurt Locker that I had seen him in as well, but especially in The Hurt Locker, I was just like, hey, it's the guy from SWAT. He's actually doing something good. But yeah, I feel like he's been a guy who's been doing consistently good work for a long time now, and I guess I'm glad to see him getting recognition, even if I wouldn't have necessarily put him in there over someone like, say, Andrew Garfield for The Social Network.
Yeah, The Kids Are All Right, Mark Ruffalo, I think that was kind of worthy.
He was good. He's what you'd expect from Mark Ruffalo.
He's probably the best part of the movie.
Yeah, and he's kind of dropped at the end a little bit, which is kind of disconcerting.
Again, check out my essay where I rail about it. Jeffrey Rush, The King's Speech, Again, I like King's Speech. It's a nice movie. Like,
yeah, I'm going to bring up something that maybe I'm just so painfully ignorant, but they keep saying in that movie that he's Australian, but he doesn't have an Australian accent. And I don't know if I'm just like completely, I don't know. We'll have to get an email address and see if we can get some listeners to write in and tell us some of this stuff. But I don't know. Is he supposed to have an Australian accent and they just abandoned it? Or maybe there were no Australian accents?
Maybe he's just from, I can't remember how long he'd been back in the UK.
I suppose that's possible. Maybe he's of Australian descent or something
so
like
that. So yes, moving in a better clip. I will say this, Christian Bale is probably a front runner for The Fighter, but he kind of steals.
I'll say that much.
He kind of steals the movie and he makes it really awesome.
He has a great scene in the ring at the end where he's kind of,
you shouldn't even explain what is about to happen because then you're ruining something.
It's a movie about, I guess it ends up, it's where two characters end up.
But he's got a good ending.
You know it's going to end with a boxing
match. But still. So okay. Christian Bale has a good moment towards
the end. He has a great moment toward the end of the movie that I feel like the movie became his after that moment. I didn't care anymore about Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah.
I only cared about Christian Bale. And I want to bring up, when was the last time, I mean, Christian Bale is so the front runner for this award. Like, I feel comfortable saying he's already won it, let's say that. But when was the last time, if ever, that there has been a major comic book franchise and the lead actor in a comic book franchise is going to have won an Oscar during that period? Like, you can't say for, like, Christopher Reeve for Superman or Tobey Maguire for Spider-Man or something. Like, we're going to have a trailer for The Dark Knight Rises that will probably say Academy Award winner Christian Bale in the lead role as Batman. Like,
yeah.
I mean,
that's pretty bitching.
Clearly, those movies are a step above other things of that ilk. But, I mean, I guess Robert Downey Jr. got nominated for an Academy Award for Tropic Thunder. I feel weird just saying that he was nominated for an Oscar for that, but
hey, he was awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like that movie, but I like him in that movie.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that was right in the heat of Iron Man, but I don't know, that was kind of one of those weird things where that was just, like, the fifth nomination. He wasn't going to win, but, like, Christian Bale is going to win, and then he's going to go, and what's his next project going to be? It's going to be playing Bruce Wayne, and I just think that's awesome that you can get actors of that caliber to play people like that, and I feel like, not to get too much out of our topic, but with Spider-Man, Andrew Garfield is going to be playing the new Spider-Man, and I feel like that's an actor that you wouldn't expect to play a role like that, and I'm super happy that they're going out of their way to find actors, not just movie stars.
Yeah. But anyways, we're going to then cut to our Best Supporting Actress. Got Amy Adams in The Fighter, Helena Bonham Carter in The King's Speech, Melissa Leo in The Fighter, Hailee Steinfeld in True Grit, and Jackie Weaver, Animal Kingdom. My first comment is Hailee Steinfeld plays the lead character in True Grit. She is the first person that we interact with. She is the person who leads the whole thing through. I'm kind of annoyed that she got billed as the supporting role. And especially because the whole film is about her proving herself as a 14-year-old girl in the West as somebody who can lead a bunch of guys who are in their 30s or even older. So anyways, that's my first thing. I mean, it's great that she got nominated, but I don't think she got nominated in the right category.
Yeah, the Academy is funny sometimes where they put their leading actors or actresses in supporting. I think the thing is, if you look at a movie like Whale Rider that got nominated, Keisha Casley Hughes got nominated for Best Leading Actress for that movie. She didn't have a co-star. She didn't have somebody The Whale Rider, it's called.
But was the whale her co-star?
I don't think there's a whale in that movie.
Oh.
I haven't seen the movie. I haven't seen the movie. But she didn't have a co-star like Jeff Bridges that's stealing all the thunder. I mean,
He didn't steal the thunder. I mean, the only thing that he has on her is that he's just a bigger named actor.
True. But the way the Academy sees it, he is the big name and they recognize him first because he's who sells the movie. I mean, even if you look at the poster for True Grit, I don't even think Hailee Steinfeld's name is on it. And so you could tell that even the people who were promoting the movie didn't think that she was worthy. There wasn't even an introducing Hailee Steinfeld or something like that.
Is a fine example of the type of politics and the mix of commercial as well as this award. Like, it's supposed to be an award ceremony that's supposed to honor craft, but it's
also
an intersection of commerce because it shouldn't matter how she's advertised in the film. Or in trailers and whatnot. Like, what should matter is, like, in the narrative, who is the main character? And she is it. But if you want to go for the commercial aspect...
Okay, I guess I'm justifying the Oscars a little bit too much. But here's the thing. Leading actress is a crowded field this year. Would you rather see her get nominated for supporting actress or not at all?
I mean, she outdoes Annette Bening.
That's not the question, though. It's a question of who the Oscars are going to nominate, not who deserves to be nominated.
But you just said that it's crowded. I think it would be better if she got...
It's crowded for the Oscars. I think
what you're saying is...
leading actress, but there are four locks
in
that
category. So what you're saying is, if she wasn't nominated for supporting role,
fit in leading role.
But I still call shenanigans, because if they're going to nominate her for anything, it should be leading role. Or nothing at all.
Like, okay, so you're saying you would rather have her not be nominated than to be nominated?
Well, because
it's
like a commendation, but with a slap in the face as well. It's like,
I think she's 14 years old. I think she'll be okay with an Academy Award.
Good job, but at the same time, you weren't the leading character. And it's just, so, anyways, that's all I've got on that.
I gotta say, I'm not too high on this category.
Well, all these roles, like Amy Adams in The Fighter, all she does is prance around kind of naked.
She has a tramp stamp. That's you wouldn't expect Amy Adams to have a tramp stamp, but she does. And so she gets.
I don't even know who that is.
Who is
Amy Adams? Why would it be surprising if she had a tramp
stamp? She's like the good girl. Like, haven't you ever seen Doubt or anything like that?
She's always
like the little prissy girl. She's the innocent one.
Oh, okay. So,
and so to have her play...
So this is her Christina Aguilera dirty moment where she has to slum it up and be sort of naked to prove that she's willing to do dirty roles.
That's an interesting comparison, I guess. Sure, yes.
Okay. I mean, so Helen Bonham Carter,
I think a lot of people... I think her performance is subtle, and that's something that the Academy doesn't award enough, so I guess I'm not too angry that she's in there. But I think really what she's being nominated for is the fact that she's not Helena Bonham Carter in the movie. She's not...
Well, okay.
Like, she's in Harry Potter or in Sweeney Todd. She's not over the top.
Melissa Leo in The Fighter.
Someone who is over the top.
I'm just going to say this right now. The Academy likes to nominate terrible stereotypes. I'm just going to say that, like, Precious, that was just offensive in the way that it hit on every single African-American stereotype, and then...
With no real attempt to subvert it.
Yeah, exactly. It was not Black Dynamite. so then it becomes... For the Academy to nominate some of these people in their roles, I mean, like, okay, let me get into details here. So Melissa Leo, I would assume that's Mark Wahlberg's mother in The Fighter, I remember correctly. Okay, so she plays a lower class, kind of what you would call, quote, trashy type character. And it seems like, you know, when Charlize Theron played the serial killer in Monster, it was, like, such a big deal because she put on some weight and looked ugly and, you know, it's... Oh, thanks for lowering yourself to
this. Halle Berry in Monster's Ball. Yeah, they like to watch pretty actresses get ugly for a role. Exactly.
So it's, so take some of these nominations with a grain of salt, because some of it, I just feel like you did a good job of reconfirming the stereotypes that we have of poor people.
And she's probably going to win. So, she won the Golden Globe and she won the Critics' Choice Award. She's, I'd say, the front runner, but her performance is very showy, and it's easier to appeal. It's easier
There's
to get
that most
a showy
acting.
Role.
There's
for
the
sure.
most
yes.
acting
for
element.
Sure.
Yeah.
I agree.
So I have frequently been hearing about this film called Animal Kingdom. I've yet to see it yet.
I have seen it. I'm unimpressed with Jackie Weaver's performance. I'm not going to throw under the bus because, I mean, let's face it. She's not like a famous actress. She got into this. Good for her. I mean, she gave a good performance. I don't think it's the thing that everybody is saying it is.
Gotcha.
It felt a little over the top to me, and I guess, there you go again, most acting. It just seemed like one of those performances that, it just didn't seem impressive to me. It just seemed like oh, okay, anybody could have done that performance. Yeah. I didn't see much acting talent to it.
Yeah.
And as opposed to other performances in the movie, there's a great actor, Ben Mendelsohn, who has a very scary character in the movie.
Oh, I've heard about this.
And he does a much better job. There's no way he's going to get nominated for an Oscar. There's just no way he'd fit. But I would have much rather seen him get nominated than someone like Jackie Weaver. But you know what? Good for her. She got a nomination. Maybe she'll get some movies out. She's this year's Christoph Waltz, I guess. She's the
Christoph Waltz being the Jew hunter in Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah, so his...
Except Christoph Waltz is an amazing actor, and maybe this Jackie Weaver is not.
Maybe, but maybe you'll be seeing her in The Green Hornet 2 next year.
Okay. Christoph Waltz, by the way, if you find yourself stuck seeing The Green Hornet, he's like the only thing worth seeing, so just chew on it while you can. So I even though Hailee Steinfeld should be in Best Actress in a role, I hope that she at least wins for the nomination she received for Best Supporting Role. So we're going to go to Best Actress in a Leading Role. We have Annette Bening in The Kids Are All Right, Nicole Kidman in Rabbit Hole, Jennifer Lawrence in Winter's Bone, Natalie Portman in Black Swan, and Michelle Williams in Blue Valentine. And I'm going to lead this charge really quick. First off, Jennifer Lawrence is, I think she's specifically a Louisville, Kentucky native, which is where I hail from. So awesome that that she got nominated. And also, I've had this on standby when we were mentioning John Hawkes, because we were talking a lot about how great he is in Winter's Bone. This is what I wrote in my review of Winter's Bone about Jennifer Lawrence. Winter's Bone deserves a viewing for its bleak visuals and the raw performance from Jennifer Lawrence's Ree. Uncompromised by the usual sexualized overtones and a determined attitude that belies the whiny, wimpy trappings of other female characters stuck in a rut, Lawrence is just awesome. Her steely gunslinger gaze and the nobility of her quest come through her graceful and intimidating performance. And she, yeah, so she's awesome. I hope she gets it, although there are some other people on here that are pretty good. So I'm gonna pass this over to Scott.
See what you think. Just to state my opinion, I agree wholeheartedly about Jennifer Lawrence. I think that's a performance that's so difficult for a young actor or actress just because it requires so much maturity. And I think she really nails it.
And it's very understated.
For
it's
sure.
Very, I don't want to spoil anything, but Winter's Bone, like, it, with almost any interaction that this girl, Ree Dolly, has with somebody, the story is she's trying to track down her father, because if she doesn't find him, then their house is going to get repossessed. Every interaction that she has with someone, you're just so fearful for her that she's just going to get beat up or killed or you don't know what. And it's just very impressive how strong she remains throughout the film without having to resort to the usual tropes that we associate with strength, you know, like just physical prowess or brandishing a firearm and whatnot. It's all in her face, and it's all in her body language, and that comes through, like, really well. So I don't know if...
I agree with it, all of that.
Anything else on here? I mean,
Much as I like Jennifer Lawrence's performance, I think my pick and the person, maybe my pick for who will win and my pick for who should win has got to be Natalie Portman for Black Swan. I feel like she really nailed that performance. That's the performance of her career for sure. And I think it's great because I really want to see her go in other directions. And I guess her next, her romantic comedy that just came out, the one about her and Ashton Kutcher. I mean, so maybe that's her going back to the well, but I feel like teaming up with Darren Aronofsky and doing something different than you'd expect from this starlet, for lack of a better term, I thought that was really brave. And I thought, and I know your argument was that we see her in a little bit too much in the same mode the entire movie, but I feel like there are subtle differences to the way she goes through the movie. And I feel like she is relied on to convey the increased tension as the movie goes along. And I think without her doing that, without her starting in a very feeble place and the tension just ratcheting up and till we get to the end where she's a completely different character to begin, like, than she was at the beginning of the movie. I think that takes a lot of acting talent that you couldn't just convey in a script or as the director. I think that's something that you really have to credit to Natalie Portman.
And I'm not arguing with your assessment. I just realized that there is a very apt way to describe my issue with Natalie Portman in that. And it's just like The Shining. The major complaint against The Shining from Stephen King and other people
is that he starts that way.
He starts crazy and then he ends crazy. He isn't a normal guy like in the book, and he gradually becomes crazy. And I guess that was my problem with Natalie Portman in the film, is I already thought that she was messed up at the beginning. And so by the end, there wasn't really any sort of change for me to connect with. Now, understandably, her craziness is a sort of intensifying thing, but at the same time, that was just to properly, I guess, describe my issue, which you had mentioned, yeah. That was all. So
let me counter-argue a little bit just to say, with both of those performances, I think what makes them great performances, and I love The Shining, and I love Black Swan, and I think it's that those two characters, in order for them to go where they go, they had to at least have had that in themselves to begin with. And I feel like if Jack Nicholson was this good guy at the beginning of The Shining, like he is, I suppose, in the book, I haven't read the book, but I've heard that Stephen King argument. I just feel like if he had started so good and turned so evil, it wouldn't ring true. It would, like, you need to think at the beginning of the movie that he is the kind of guy who might abuse his wife and son, because if he isn't that kind of guy to begin with, then how does he end up the way he is? And I guess you could argue that ghosts are possessing him and whatnot, but like...
But then it's just a matter of subjectivity about where you think that line is, because for me, he didn't go anywhere with it from that point. But okay. For you, at the beginning, he is different from how he is at the end. So we were talking about Jennifer Lawrence and then Natalie Portman. Michelle Williams is good in Blue Valentine. Nicole Kidman is... I'd say Nicole Kidman and Annette Bening, they're not really the strongest people on this list.
No, in fact, I'd say that Julianne Moore was far better in The Kids Are All Right, yep, than Annette Bening.
Yeah. All right. So that leads us to actor in a leading role. We have Javier Bardem in Beautiful, Jeff Bridges, True Grit, Jesse Eisenberg, The Social Network, Colin Firth, The King's Speech, James Franco, 127 Hours.
Well, your grr, is that because you don't think he's the leading role? Because I feel
yes,
like you can
that's
have
a... the reason. That's the reason. Well, okay.
He could be a leading role. I think he is a leading role. I don't think you could say that Jeff Bridges is supporting in True Grit. He's in, like, every
okay,
scene.
But if you're comparing the two, then I would say...
He's less leading than Hailee Steinfeld, but
yes.
I still think he should be in... I mean, he
okay.
should be in supporting.
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, if anything, at least get a supporting role. If Hailee Steinfeld got the same, if she got nominated for leading role, I wouldn't have too much of a problem, I guess, if Jeff Bridges also is in a leading role. It's just the fact that he gets the leading role over her, and I that's my problem. Let's
for
see.
This category, Colin Firth is going to win.
Yes. That's what the Academy's going to pick, but what
yeah,
do we
sure.
like? How
about I
well,
like
we still haven't seen. We still haven't seen Beautiful. I'm sure Bardem's going to be awesome. And, okay, I'm going to give a shout-out to my friend and also another contributor to thefilmsmith.com, Ben Creech. He told me to rewatch The Social Network, and maybe I will change my opinion of it. So initially, I'm not a fan. I will rewatch it. But because I'm not too hot on it, James Franco, I'm not really too impressed by this list. You know what's missing? Ryan Gosling. We're missing us some Ryan Gosling in Blue Valentine, because I think he's a lot better than Colin Firth in The King's Speech, at least.
I think we're selling Colin Firth short a little bit. I mean, Colin Firth, I don't know if he would win this year had he not been in A Single Man last year. I feel like this is a two-year award where it's kind of like, well, we couldn't give it to him last year, so...
But the thing is, we shouldn't be following that logic and being like, okay, it's okay because they didn't give it to him last year.
True. I mean,
I don't know if that's what you were doing.
No.
But, okay. But I mean, he does do a good job. But as far as, I mean, I guess Ryan Gosling is kind of playing a similar character to someone he's played. He doesn't reinvent himself every time in the same way that Johnny Depp's early career.
I feel like Ryan Gosling almost goes out of his way to try to reinvent himself for every role, and it just ends up not working.
Well, okay, maybe I'm just seeing a lot of similarities between, I think it's Ryan Dunn and Half Nelson in this one, and that's why I said that. But you're right. No, when I think about some of his other films, yeah. But, yeah, I mean, are you, like, totally gung-ho Jesse Eisenberg?
I'm
definitely,
gonna,
or is it kind of like...
As far as
you personally, how do you feel about it?
I'm going to jump on the Social Network bandwagon, which is what I've been doing all day here, and say that Jesse Eisenberg is my favorite leading male performance of 2010. I thought he did a great job in a role that could have otherwise been a really hated person. I think he brought a lot of character to someone that wasn't, at least at the time the film was released, wasn't very well liked to a certain extent.
I mean,
based
I still
on
don't
the
think,
film.
I don't think he's well liked.
I think
now,
he
still.
Finds sympathy in the character in a way that I wouldn't have expected them to. I was very worried that the film would come off like a character bash kind of thing on Mark Zuckerberg, and I feel like they did a good job of not doing that and finding reasons for why he did what he did and not turning him into the villain. I guess, yes, I'm on the Jesse Eisenberg bandwagon. Unfortunately, I don't think he's going to win, but I'm very happy to say that he's Academy Award nominated.
So I guess maybe that's about all we have to say about those. So we can go to Best Directing. We have Darren Aronofsky for Black Swan, David O. Russell for The Fighter, Tom Hooper for The King's Speech, David Fincher for The Social Network, Joel and Ethan Coen for True Grit.
I think it's a good category this year. I think Tom Hooper is thrown in there because they like The King's Speech. I don't necessarily think that his direction is the thing that anyone will remember from that movie.
No.
It's more the acting. It's pretty much thoroughly the acting that people like about that movie. But when you're a Best Picture frontrunner, a Best Director nomination comes along with it. So I think David Fincher did a fantastic job of reining himself in way more than you would have expected. I remember I remember when people were first talking about when this movie first got announced, and they were just like, David Fincher's directing? Are we going to see all these camera shots that go into the computer and through things and stuff like that? And I thought he did a great job of making it. He found the truth of the movie, which is in its characters and in its dialogue, and he focuses on that and portraying that in the most interesting way possible. And he doesn't, with the exception of a few sequences, like I guess the regatta sequence, he does get a little into the flair for the visual, I guess, but for the most part, I think he really did a good job of reining in what he had done in movies like, I guess I'm specifically thinking of Panic Room, but he's certainly known as being a guy with a visual flair to him, and I feel like that had a lot of people saying, well, why is he directing this movie? And I feel like he proved them all wrong, and I think that's why he deserves to win.
Well, none of these films are on my top 10 list, so I don't have too much to say. I mean, I like The Fighter. I had trouble connecting with Black Swan.
I think it's hard to argue that there's not some expert direction going on in that.
But yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, my problem was I couldn't identify. I didn't really feel much for the character by the end. So everything up until that point, you know, Aronofsky's a flipping master at what he does. So I think I would be supremely surprised if Aronofsky were to win. But I think that would be awesome, because then that would give him a little bit more leverage. So I guess we would probably vote for The Social Network or Black Swan.
Those would be the two I would go with, yeah.
So, all right. Finally, we have our official considerations for Best Picture. We have Black Swan, The Fighter, Inception, The Kids Are All Right, The King's Speech, 127 Hours, The Social Network, Toy Story 3, True Grit, and Winter's Bone. Well, I think overall, I think Inception definitely deserves to be up here more than Avatar for last year.
Inception is definitely, I mean, I didn't like either movie really, but I think Inception is more ambitious, and so it deserves more credit. But in the end, I mean, I like Inception better than I like Avatar for sure, but I still feel like it doesn't deserve to be in Best Picture just because I feel like it fails so miserably at what it was going for.
Which I would say I don't agree. I think yes, it's not as good maybe as The Dark Knight, but at the same time, summer blockbusters are just so bad, it seems, with such regularity. It was compared to what it could have been, and its colleagues during the summer season, I think it's really good. Mm-hmm. I wasn't too big of a fan of The Social Network or Black Swan, but you know, that doesn't necessarily mean anything, everyone.
Yeah, those two are definitely my picks for this category. So we definitely differ on that. But it's going to be The Social Network or The King's Speech. Those are the two movies that are really the front runners. And between those, I definitely got to go with The Social Network.
Yeah, I would kind of piss myself with glee if Winter's Bone somehow won. Because
you'll be holding
your breath. I'll be holding my bladder. because out of the one, I mean, let's see, on my top 10 lists, Inception's on there, and so is Winter's Bone, but True Grit, Toy Story 3, The Social Network. I really liked 127 Hours, but I just felt like it was a little too on the nose. The King's Speech, it's nice. The Kids Are All Right. I have no idea what it was thinking in the last act. The Fighter's good. Black Swan. You know, I think it's a decent lineup.
I think I've had the problem this year just that my opinions and the opinions of mainstream have not lined up very well this year. I guess if The Social Network won, that would be lining up pretty well. But, I mean, Toy Story 3, Inception, The Kids Are All Right, The King's Speech, none of those are movies that I particularly liked all that much. And so to have all those kind of being front runners, this year isn't really a year that I'm particularly interested in the race.
Between the two of us, we're both like, forget it.
So now that we're coming to the end, I want to ask one more question. if you could choose, let's say, one film that you would have nominated for Best Picture, and I'm going to go one step further and say, what would you take out? What is the movie that you think should not be nominated for Best Picture, and what would you replace it with? Not to put you on the spot.
I wonder if it would be spite or if it would be legitimate if I just took out The King's Speech, because I'm just tired of hearing about it and hearing about, oh, it's so good, but it's really not that exceptional for any reason whatsoever. If I were going to take one out...
Just go for it. Just say King's Speech.
Yeah, you know what? Forget King's Speech.
Just
like,
own it.
It's just this big, nice movie, but it's nothing... Like, I've seen better things on DVD lately than this. So, yeah. You know what? Yeah, I got it. I'd take out The King's Speech. I'd put in The American.
The American. I can't disagree with that. The American was great, and it really was underrated.
So... I guess in the advertising scheme for The American, you got George Clooney made out to be this thriller assassin film, and it's much more quiet and understated. And so a lot of people, of course, you go in expecting maybe a Jason Statham romp, and then you just get something that feels more like, I want to say The Reporter, if I can remember the title correctly. A throwback to kind of 1970s thrillers. And because of that, it has a very simple story. It's nothing too convoluted, but it's the way that it's visually displayed, and that simplicity is really what stays with you. So yeah, I mean, it was, I sat down and watched it with my wife, and then the next day she's like, you know, I really like The American. And I felt like that was a good measurement of the film's quality. So yeah, forget The King's Speech. Go watch The American. You can rent it right now. And you for yourself?
For me, I guess I'll start with what I'd take out. I think I'd take out Toy Story 3. I really don't feel like that belongs as high up. And I'm not going to go bashing it, but I feel like Pixar gets enough love that they can afford one person bashing them. I loved Up. I loved Ratatouille. I didn't love WALL-E, but we won't get into that. I just don't feel like Toy Story 3 is a good movie for anyone over the age of 10 or whatever. It didn't seem to me to really do what other great films do. I thought it was too kind of emotionally manipulative in certain ways, and I just didn't feel like it belonged certainly in a list of the 10 best movies of the year. What I would replace it with is, I guess I didn't think about this until now, but a good replacement for it, a movie that I feel like started, or at least a franchise that I feel started for kids only and has slowly grown up with its audience, and that's Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1. I fell in love with that movie in a way that I was not expecting. That franchise has had its highs and lows, to be sure, but this one felt like the best that they've done. And from the direction to the cinematography to the acting from these kids, what a find these kids are. I mean, they found them when they were like 9 years old, and now they are carrying an 8-film franchise on their backs. And now this one, it's just them. They don't have anyone else to rely on like they have in previous movies. And I really feel like they knocked it out of the park. And I just felt like this is a grown-up movie that started as a kid's movie. And I was really impressed by that. I find like it's been a great franchise to grow up with. And it just seems like so many people are saying that this movie was half of a whole or anything like that. I find nothing about it different from The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, where that movie ends on a cliffhanger, and there's going to be two more movies. You knew there was going to be another movie to go along with this, and let's face it, most people don't just watch the first part of Lord of the Rings. They watched all three of them in like some way, shape, or form. They're not just going to say like, oh, I only like the second one, I'm only going to watch it. It's like, yes, it's part of a greater whole, but the whole franchise is. I mean, it's 8 films, and none of them, I mean, some of them feel maybe more complete than others, but for the most part, they're driven by this very rigid structure of 1 year at Hogwarts or something like that. This movie gets rid of all of that. It's so much more interesting to see them out on their own, and that provides for a lot better production design and cinematography that they really couldn't do when they were just limited to these Hogwarts sets.
And a kick-ass diner shootout with Wands.
Very true, yes. I mean, like, there's Western influences. It works so well. The visual effects are amazing. There's this excellent sequence where they open up a locket and just pure evil spits out of it. And it's one of the most photoreal things I've seen on screen before.
Although that's really kind of disturbing on a level that kind of takes you out of it. But that's...
Well, you know what? I'll say this movie is dark. And that is not what I expected. I mean, there are several sequences in this movie where it's not just like people dealing with horrible or like horror movie-ish situations. It's also the trials that the characters are going through. I mean, there's death in this movie there was death before, but there's a lot of death in this movie. And just the fact that you have all these kids characters that all these kids are going to see, and you're watching them deal with like really horrific events in their lives and this really dramatic stuff. I just feel like they nailed it like so well in this. And all credit has got to be given to Daniel Radcliffe, who I think is so much better than, I'm a huge Star Wars fan, such a better actor than Mark Hamill. I mean, he carries that movie. And that's so, like, impressive for, I think, what, he's, like, 22 now or something like that. And he started as, like, a 10 or 11-year-old. And just the fact that he's been able to do so much with this role that could have very easily been very one-note. I mean, I like Luke Skywalker. He's not exactly the most three-dimensional character. He's more or less just your standard, typical hero. But I feel like Daniel Radcliffe does things that you wouldn't have expected from a movie like Harry Potter. And that is why I would say it should be nominated for Best Picture.
All right, so yank Toy Story 3 and yank The King's Speech and plug them in with Harry Potter and The Deathly Hallows Part 1 and The American. And speaking of The American really briefly, I just want to say it was not the reporter. I meant to say The Passenger that I compared The American to. It's a Jack Nicholson film in 1975.
So check that one out.
Indeed, The American. Watch it.
Not the other one?
No, I mean, I just made the comparison because it's similar, but the Passenger, I felt like nothing really happened. The American, there's a little bit more light shined on the character. And George Clooney's pretty awesome in that. So that has been our exhaustive discussion of the list of Oscar winners presented this week. But I want to thank everyone who may be listening. And we will hope to have a regular podcast offered. Again, we're representing thefilmsmith.com. Check it out. News reviews, some essays every now and again. And my name is Remington Smith and
Scott Molling.
So thanks for listening and have a good night.